Without further ado, let's give a very warm welcome to Vandana Shiva. Thank you so much.
This is the America I love. That makes peace at home rather than itch to create wars here, there, and everywhere. And of course, the new wars are more fascinating because, as you know, your government has just signed an agreement with my government to spread nuclear as clean energy. And for the same reasons, poor Iran now needs to be targeted. So nuclear is safe if it's strategically a strategic partnership with India, and unsafe in the hands of Iran. And what could be worse double standards? But we are not talking nuclear today. I left that. I left that 30 years ago. Though I think I'll have to get involved in nuclear politics again for the issues of energy. Today I want to just spend time with you continuing the wonderful discussion and introductions that have been made, because I do at home exactly what all the amazing campaigns here are doing. Yeah. We have our little education for sustainable living. I started it with Satish Kumar, who is the inspiration behind the ESLP. And we had to, you know, I mean, Satish is typically, you know, I was doing the wreath lecture and he announces that I'm starting a school and he says, Vandana, what will be the name of the school? And since I'm so inspired and obsessed with the seed, I said, well, it'll be the Beej Vidyapeeth, which means the school of the seed. So you can forget the rest of it. Just remember the school of the seed. Beej is the seed. Ja. Life, be that in which life resides, to be self-renewed in perpetuity. The embodiment of life itself. And besides the school, for 20 years I've been saving seeds, largely because of the awareness I was fortunate to have of what the plans were, what the corporate plans were. This was a period before WTO, remember. WTO only came into being 1995. But it took them one decade of preparations to get there through what is called the Uruguay Round of GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. Now, the General Agreement was never supposed to deal in agriculture. Agriculture was never supposed to be first and foremost a subject matter of trade. It was first and foremost about the land, about taking care of the soil, about the livelihoods of farmers, about the nourishment for our communities. The General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs created an agreement on agriculture, AOA, which is what is leading to the collapse of WTO. I don't know how many of you have followed the fact that the negotiations are as good as dead right now. Which is, of course, wonderful as far as WTO is concerned, but not very good for sustainable farming because they find other ways. And I'll talk about that during this evening. The multilaterals are being replaced by bilaterals. And one of the bilaterals is this crazy knowledge agreement in agriculture, a second agreement which you don't hear so much about. The Time, Newsweek, everyone covered nuclear. Nobody talked about the agreement and the agreement on agriculture called the knowledge agreement. And on the board of with India and US, and on the board of this agreement are, guess who? Monsanto and Walmart. Walmart doesn't exist in India yet. Yeah? The agreement pretends to be a knowledge agreement, but is basically about corporate grab of the largest body of free and independent farmers in the world. 600 million of them. Why are we free and independent? First and foremost, because we were colonized. And we fought colonization. Colonization had left us with hunger. If you've done history or food, you'll have read about the Great Bengal Famine. Killed 2 million people, largely because the rice that was being grown was then being exported to feed the war, to basically feed the armies of that time. While the people who had grown the rice were starving because the revenue system of British colonialism was such that they literally extracted half the produce. Half the produce was forced out as revenue. And the women in that time, in 1942, after the Bengal famine, started an amazing movement in Bengal called Tebhaga, which basically said, we will keep two-thirds, you take one-third, rather than the 50%, 33%. And the slogan was beautiful. It said, Jaan debo, dhaan debo na. We will give our lives, but we will not give our rice. And we have programs in Bengal, and I've traveled in small villages, and in tiny villages, you know, in Delhi they've forgotten that these kind of movements brought us the freedom we today enjoy. But in little villages, frescoes on the wall with women standing in front of their paddy harvest with brooms, and the British army with guns, trying to get the rice. And women were shot, they were killed, but eventually, 47, we got independence. One of the first things that was done was land reform. Because colonialism had taken land away from the peasants, everywhere in the world. Independence meant give land back to the cultivator. Let the cultivator be the owner of land. And that required the opposite of landlordism. It required a ceiling on land. It required a limit to how much land you could own. And that changed according to whether you were in a dry area where you needed larger areas to till, or if you were in an irrigated area where you needed smaller land, or if you were in a very fertile soil where you needed even less land. So the ceiling was totally proportionate to how much land you needed to survive. I believe that one simple decision of land ceiling and land reform was probably the most significant in reversing the poverty that India had sunk into as a result of colonialism. I was just having a debate on BBC because of the collapse of the current round of WTO negotiations. And there was a WTO person on the, you know, these are radio interviews, someone sitting in Geneva, and there was a Washington trade expert. And of course, both of them started to, with what was good for India. Yeah, sitting here in Washington and Geneva saying, you know, India should do this. India should that do that, and this will be good for Indians. And I said, can an Indian living in India say what we think will be good for India? And they kept talking about how, you know, we have one of the highest so-called growth rates of in the world, economic growth. We are sort of now in that 10% league. And our Sensex, our stock market, has hit 12,000 points. So in every measure of what an economy is in terms of doing well, we are doing brilliantly. But I live in the India where peasants are being shot and killed in defense of their land and water. We've just come back from Rajasthan where 5 farmers were killed to take the water of farmers to the cities to flush toilets. What else do you do? You know, you don't irrigate fields. You don't recharge aquifers in cities. The biggest use is golf clubs, swimming pools, and toilet flushing. And here were farmers in a desert trying to defend their water. Five of them shot dead, and I would even read out the names to you, because one of them was a woman who was serving the protesters' water in the heat. So Prakash Mali, Gujar, Madanlal Jat, Krishnalal Chaudhary, Ram Narayan Chaudhary. 12 tribal shot dead for defending their land from the setting up of a steel mill for exporting steel. You might also know the biggest steel magnate of the world now is an Indian living in England, a person called Mittal. And of course, when these kind of discussions happen, suddenly he is Indian, not a global grabber. You know, I said, what's so Indian about him? Lives in England, grabs companies all over the world. The color of your skin doesn't make you what you are. The soil you live on and return nourishment to is what makes you what you are. The communities you serve is what makes you what you are. And I think we are reaching this extremely schizophrenic situation where there's a nationalism at one level, and all destruction of any sense of belonging, either local or national identity, at another level through globalization. So we're going on with this discussion in BBC about how much India is being harmed, the India of the people. And this WTO expert turns around and said, of course there has to be wrenching, and of course there has to be pain. We went through it 200 years ago when our peasants were uprooted, but we got rich. And I said, you got rich because you just went out and grabbed every continent of the world. You didn't get rich because you uprooted your peasants. But I think that historical amnesia is probably one of the biggest myths that is destroying small family farms. Because there's this crazy narrative that says small farms disappeared in England, the West became rich, therefore, conclusion, destroy small farms to create wealth. That's how they think. And I had to tell this WTO expert, I said, you know, a second-grade kid in India would know more about reality and history than you two. You just cook up history to your convenience to then create fake trade theories to enclose not just land, but all commons that are needed for life itself. And I think whether we are here in California or in India, we have this one big challenge, the big fundamentalism that farmers and farming are the root of poverty. The end of poverty requires the end of farming. Read chapter one of the guru of the ending of poverty, Jeffrey Sachs, his fat book, called How to End Poverty. How many of you have read it? Good, thank goodness, only two. No one should read it. It should be pulped. But I read it because Jeffrey Sachs now runs the Earth Institute, nothing less than an Earth Institute. The man doesn't know a thing about the Earth. He was the one who went around destroying Russia's economy, Bolivia's economy, imposing structural adjustment. And then they hand him over the Earth Institute and say, now you can destroy the planet. Yeah. Structurally adjust the planet to your economic thinking. He calls it clinical economics, you know. The whole planet and all of us are diseased. We need fixing. Well, his entire thesis is based on getting people out of agriculture, that poverty is caused by people being in agriculture. Then he goes on to say, yes, of course, the women in China and the women in Bangladesh and Sri Lanka who are making the cheap jeans that allow Walmart to bring you cheap clothing, of course they're exploited, and they're not allowed to go to the toilet, and they have 30-hour shifts, and they have this, and they have that. But they are on the first rung of the development ladder. And that first rung is get out of agriculture. I think the reason this evening is so beautiful and all this, you know, what Nancy showed and what the group that works on with Family Farm Support showed, and what all your activism on the campus is showing and in the community, is that farming is not a past that can disappear. Farming is humanity's future. I've increasingly come to this conclusion from many, many directions. I started to think and work on agriculture largely as a result of the kind of violence that I witnessed, both with the Bhopal disaster of 1984, you might remember the worst industrial disaster, and all my friends from Bhopal have just spent 20 days sitting on a hunger strike in Delhi. The Prime Minister did not meet them for a long time, but eventually he did and accepted things like cleaning up the water and creating a commission to bring them relief. But the two demands he did not accept were the demand to bring justice through bringing to trial the people of Union Carbide and now Dow. And he said, if I do this, foreign direct investment will stop. So FDI is higher value than the 30,000 lives that have gone. Yeah? And you can just see how trade changes, how the obsession with trade and investment above all else changes the sense of obligation of governments. For them, the obligation to the investors is higher. And if those investors are killers, then protecting the killers is higher than the protecting the lives of the citizens under the Constitution, which should be binding the government. Well, Bhopal was one disaster, but the other disaster was Punjab. Punjab, as you might know, is the land of the Green Revolution. It was called green because they wanted an alternative to red. Of course, in my worldview, if you're not green, you're not red, and if you're not red, you're not green. You can't have justice without ecology, and you can't have good ecological sustainability without justice. Yeah. Well, the Green Revolution wasn't so green. It was basically the name given to introduction of industrial chemical agriculture. It left devastated soils. It had to be subsidized because how on earth can you do an agriculture where costs of production keep increasing to buy chemicals and machinery and the value of the produce keeps declining? An agriculture of that negative economy, because it is a negative economy, yeah, the input costs are always higher. In industrial agriculture, costs of production will always be higher than the value of the produce. And there's no other system of production in which this happens or can happen. That is why you need the $400 billion subsidies in OECD countries, which is, again, at the root of the deadlock in WTO. Because the southern countries are saying, oh, but you'd promised to reduce subsidies, you'd promised to remove subsidies, you'd promised to create a level playing field, but the field is getting more and more unlevel. It has to. Because if your factory farming has to intensify, if your high-tech agriculture, you know, where they talk about farmer doesn't need to know what the soil condition is, we'll tell him by satellite. That's what the corporations keep saying. You know, our satellites will tell you how much water to apply. The farmer doesn't need a brain. And that's part of the problem. They have taken the farmer's brain away and put in the place of the farmer's brain their propaganda. The propaganda then ends up creating the mess that Punjab was left with, where we were told it'll produce more food, or and it did. They said it'll produce more food, but they produce more rice and wheat, not more food, because we don't. I mean, can you imagine eating chapati without dal or rice without dal? But that's what happened. I mean, Every piece of land was put out of oilseeds, pulses, mixed farming, rotation cropping into monocultures of rice and wheat, pumped with chemicals. And the use of chemicals has grown 40-fold, 4,000% in Punjab. Well, in the initial stages, the World Bank gave loans for subsidies, eventually started to withdraw those loans. The farmers required 10, 15 times more urea to get the same amount of output. Inevitability, debt. In the early stages of that decline in incomes, our farmers did what your militias do, you know. In the heartland of this country, the area that started as the red here, it's interesting how the color changes meaning. But the red zones here were heart of farming country. And the militias, in my reading, were responses to a failing agricultural system. Punjab farmers took to the guns, became the early terrorists. 1984, we had an explosion of terrorism. My book, The Violence of the Green Revolution, was written at that time to figure out what was going on. Because the story was told, Green Revolution will lead to increase in prosperity for rural communities. Prosperity will lead to peace. So the Nobel Peace Prize for 1970 went to Norman Borlaug for creating the Green Revolution. And my mind is saying, this was supposed to be about peace, but here we have war, so what went wrong? And to try to figure out what went wrong, and in a process figured out what agriculture was about, who was driving it, who were the interests, found out about the roots of the chemical industry in war, and therefore it was no accident that they were turning agriculture into war, and started to think about an agriculture of peace. For the first few years, I thought, yeah. It's usually the first thing you begin when you change your thinking. 1987 is when I happened to be in Geneva and the entire GATT and preparations for the liberalizing of agriculture, creating open economies, as they say, was starting. And the industry was there and they laid out their plan and said by the turn of the century, we'll be five companies controlling food and health. And the three instruments will be freedom of investment, intellectual property rights, and genetic engineering, the tools of technology. I literally flew home and wrapped up everything else I was doing. I was working on Bhopal, I was working on dams, the Narmada, forest issues, and I said, I am going to save seeds so that at least somewhere some species can evolve in freedom, some farmers can grow food in freedom. Started as a small, small thought. Today we work with more than 300,000 farmers. And my inspiration to begin this was really first, just the basic ethical response. How can they even imagine that life is their invention? That the tremendous diversity of species is their property, their intellectual property. Intellectual property in law is property in products of the mind. Can you imagine? Tomatoes as products of the mind. Canola as products of the mind, lettuce as products of the mind. Yeah, I just imagine Monsanto as the legal personality it is, with cabbage and lettuce going out of its head. Well, of course it doesn't. First of all, Monsanto doesn't have a head. It's not a person. And these amazing species came to us through billions of years of evolution. And thousands of years of human intelligence. Intelligence so amazing that nothing that either the new breeding or genetic engineering is doing can even start touching what nature and farmers have already achieved. And I'll give you two or three examples. You've heard of this thing called golden rice. You've even seen the ads that blame those of us who questioned it as leading to blindness of children in the third world. Well, the golden rice was supposed to be rice with vitamin A as a solution to childhood blindness caused by vitamin A deficiency. After 10 years of development work, they would have managed to put 30 micrograms of beta carotene into the rice. Initially, they managed to just get yellowness in the rice in a petri dish. It would take 30 years. It would take 10 years and billions of dollars. And, of course, meantime, 80 patents. They already have 80 patents related to various aspects of the golden rice. Well, I just went back and looked at everything we use in our food. You know, Indian food, you sprinkle a few. If you're eating North Indian food, you sprinkle a few coriander leaves. If you're eating good South Indian sambar, you put a few curry leaves. Well, just those two ingredients have 1,400 micrograms per 100 grams. 70 times more vitamin A. But along the way, some farmers with whom we work came to me with the amazing red rice from the high mountains and wanted us to move it, you know, to bring it into the market. And because I was dealing with golden rice that day, I said, let me see what this red rice has in terms of vitamin A. And it had more. It had more beta carotene than genetic engineering would achieve after 10 years of research. So my response was, first of all, you don't need to look for vitamin A in rice because there's all the greens and yellows in the world for that. But if you do want to go to rice, then here is farmer-bred rice distributed to children. We have a number of members who, you know, we have producer members who grow the food and we have co-producers because we refuse to call our members in the cities consumers. It's a horrible word. It came out of tuberculosis. It means to destroy. Consume, the consumption. TB was the consumption, that which destroys your body. And in fact, that's what the supermarket of food has become. It has destroyed our bodies. It has killed. It is leaving 1 billion people without access to food. And the figure that was given about a threefold increase in people skipping food in this part of the affluent world is one indicator. But hunger is structural to the system of food production, both because it robs people of their capacity to produce and it takes away their entitlements. And you cannot access food if you have no entitlement. Well, 1 billion people hungry and 1.7 billion malnourished and suffering malnutrition because of bad food, because of junk food. It's a system cannot deliver, that it cannot deliver health. It cannot deliver nourishment. And so it is consuming, you know, having turned food into a consumption item through the maximizing of profit at every level, in the growing of it, through applying unnecessary chemicals, in the processing of it, in taking out value. That's what processing of food is, take out value. And then in the distribution of it, adding the food miles and the fossil fuels, everything that the campaign on food sustainability has already discussed and talked about. But every step of the way in the current food system is destroying and literally consuming the earth and consuming our bodies in a nasty sense. So we call our members who are not working in fields co-producers, because as Wendell Berry has said, eating is an agricultural act. In the very act of eating, you're deciding what kind of agriculture your community will have or not have. In fact, in the act of eating, you can be part of a genocide. Because in my latest book, Earth Democracy, I have a whole section on agriculture. And I think I will share this with you because normally, what happened? under my watch. Thank you. You know, the definitions of genocide given by WHO and the Human Rights Commission, this is the WHO. It defines genocide and collective violence as the instrumental use of violence by people who identify themselves as members of group, whether this group is transitory or has a more permanent identity, against another group or set of individuals in order to achieve political, economic, or social objectives. And the UN Convention on the Prevention of Genocide talks of genocide as any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethical, racial, or religious group. They leave out economic groupings, social groupings. And that is exactly where farmers fall, that farmers are connected through the act of producing food and working with the earth. And the biggest genocide taking place right now is of small farmers of the world. And in India, we have lost 40,000 farmers who've been driven to suicides as a result of indebtedness created by a globalized, industrialized agriculture. We've recently done a map, and every year we bring out a report, an update of this report we've been bringing out since the first suicide happened in India, and every year we bring out a new version of it. It's called The Seeds of Suicide. And our latest map shows very clearly where there is Monsanto, there are suicides. So one of the things I'm going to be doing when I get back is taking a journey through the regions where the suicides have become endemic. And I said 40,000, they're growing all the time, and if we don't do something, they won't stop. None of the areas where we work has had farm suicides because ecological agriculture, organic farming, repays your debt to the earth and does not leave the farmer in debt either. Industrial agriculture constantly accumulates debt with respect to the earth and, of course, leaves the farmer deeply indebted. It is a debt-creating agriculture. So we're taking this journey through three states where the Monsanto's BT cotton, which is the only genetically engineered crop grown in India yet, partly because of the movements we've built. But this BT cotton is failing. Monsanto promises 1,500 kilograms per acre. The farmers get 200 kilograms. Monsanto promises 10,000 rupees additional incomes. Farmers have losses of 6,000 rupees per acre. But what is even more fascinating, even though 20 government studies and about 50 independent studies by organizations like ours show how much loss there is for farmers using genetically engineered cotton, the studies that come out in international journals are always about the money that farmers are making. There's a recent one by Barfoot and Brooks talking about $126 million additional income. Well, where do they get their figures? They let them come from Monsanto. Monsanto gives the figures, an academic publishes a journal in a journal Science or Nature or a biotechnology magazine. And interestingly, that becomes science, even though it's propaganda, and the science of entire countries, of independent public institutions, of independent public interest organizations, is reduced to anecdotes. Another interesting division that's taking place. Science today, I mean, science was always never about epistemology. It was always about sociology. Science is what scientists do. But increasingly, science is what corporate scientists do. Because if you're an Ignacio Cepeda in the University of Berkeley and happened to do work on how corn in Mexico got contaminated, then you're going to lose your tenure. And you'll have to do a satyagraha to get it back. But Chappelle is one. I mean, there's Ignacio, besides Ignacio, there's Arpad Putsai in England, there's Nancy Oliveira in Toronto, there's three scientists, the best in Canada, who stopped the BGH being introduced. They work for Health Canada. And yet they did their work as government servants. They were hounded out of their jobs for doing an honest piece of work to show the risks. It's happening across the world. In India, the Cotton Research Institute did work to show how unstable the BT cotton was. Those scientists are being troubled. So you can't afford to be an authentic scientist in the system. You have to be a scientist who's willing to manipulate, lie, just distort everything. So we are going to go through this area and create, instead of the seeds of pseudoscience, introduce seeds of hope and seeds of life. I'm collecting seeds right now in massive quantities, including open-pollinated cotton varieties. But not just cotton, because I don't think you should just grow cotton. You need to grow something else too. Clothing comes after food. And a farmer will never be in distress if they fed their family. They will never have to lose their land if they are not in such deep debt, because the prices of cotton are also collapsing. And the issue of $4 billion subsidies, large part here in California, going to big agribusiness that is then dumping on the world, ruining African cotton, ruining Indian cotton. So we're going to do this journey, and we are starting it on the 10th of May, which is a very important date for us. It's the 149th anniversary of the first corporate revolt. The East India Company used to be ruling us then. And we had our first independence movement in 1857. There's a new film on it. I'm sure it has even come to cinema halls here. It's called The Rising. And this film is about the movement of that time. And the way people joined the movement was, we were ruled by a corporation with armies and all the censorship that's typical of that kind of rule was in place. People would send little chapatis. They'd roll a little chapati, send it on, and if you were joining the freedom movement, you rolled 10 more chapatis and sent it on. And receiving a chapati and passing it on meant you had become part of the movement. So literally, it was a movement built on bread. And we are starting this, freeing farmers of debt and suicide, and basically spending time with them, because all they've had is corporate propaganda from Monsanto. And Monsanto uses our gods, it uses our divinities, it uses anything on earth to sell them GM cotton. Yeah? They will use the Mahabharata, they'll use the Ramayana, they'll use Guru Nanak, they'll use whichever is the favorite local deity or whichever is the favorite local legend or mythology. So we'll go with our seeds, and part of the campaign is to create GMO-free, patent-free, suicide-free, debt-free regions and villages. Because the issue of slavery today is very, very clearly related to a false idea of freedom. The false idea of freedom, that the freedom of corporations to do what they want to with this planet of ours, with our food systems, with our bodies, with our minds, that is freedom for society. In fact, that is enslavement of society, and it is an extinction of large parts of society, particularly an extinction of the small holding, the small cultivator-owned farm. You call them family farms. We just call them small and marginal farmers in India. The average holding for small and marginal farmers, which account for 80% of India's land holdings, is 1 hectare. And people, even children will say to me, and sometimes when I'm talking about food, they say, but don't we need large farms to produce more? And I said, what is a large farm but the appropriation of 1,000 peasants' small farms? How will that same amount of land suddenly produce more? No. It'll produce less for the simple reason that 1,000 small farmers with one hectare per family will work on every inch of their land with care. They have the capacity, they have the potential, and they have the need to do it. I think for you, 1,000 hectares is too small, actually, isn't it? It should be 1,000 square miles. Yeah? You know, we go in thousands of square miles in this country, isn't it? So I'm just missing a few zeros. Just add them with your reliability. But the point is that the smaller the farm, the smaller the farm, the higher is the production, which is the second mythology of the current economic system. The first, small farmers lead to poverty, destroy farming, countries will go rich, the way to wealth creation. And the way to richness is the destruction of agriculture. A related myth is small farms don't produce enough. You've got to have industrial farming, large-scale farming, corporate farming in order to produce enough for the world. You're too many of you, you won't see it from here, but maybe we could put it on that. This is FAO data. Just go through some, just look at this sheet. You see, it's acreage. You can use just one of them, it's good enough. So it's the acreage versus the output, and you can see the high output is towards the lower end of acreage. Yeah? And of course, the trick is, normally when you grow food, like in the agricultural farm of Santa Cruz, you grow diversity. And when you grow diversity and you calculate diversity, small farms produce more. I just want to, you know, we've just completed our analysis on our farm. A 12-crop system will give you, for a hectare, 6,000 kilograms and will give you incomes of 100,000 rupees. A monoculture system will only give you incomes of 43,000, half. For a 9-crop system, Navdanya, the movement I started, means 9 seeds. It can also mean the new gift, depending on how you pronounce it, because we have much more variation, you know, in the way we speak. Again, a monoculture, 36,000 rupees. The 9-crop system, 100,000 rupees. A 7-crop system, 69,000 rupees. A monoculture, 48,000 rupees. A 5-crop system, 62,000 rupees. A monoculture, 26,000 rupees. The idea that you have to destroy small farms to create wealth works for corporations. It does not work for the small farm. For the small farm, the smaller the farm, the more wealth you can create by conserving diversity. And in fact, at that level, at the level of the small, ecological sustainability objectives and social justice objectives and anti-poverty objectives become one. They all converge. In no other field can you get this phenomena. But in agriculture, it's possible for the simple reason agriculture is where we as human beings can reach our highest potential with the highest potential of nature and biodiversity. And the potential of nature is limitless, as is the potential of our intelligence working in humility. Of course, there is the potential of limitless destruction of intelligence working with arrogance. And just take the example of the Terminator technology, designing seeds that will be sterile just so farmers can't save them. And then when they get caught at that, they say, oh, these are gene, what are they, GERTs they call them. Brilliant. And then they say it's to stop contamination. It is for biosafety. So the other day when I had a debate on this, on a Terminator trial, I said, that's like killing every patient in a hospital to say you're preventing infection. You're preventing iatrogenesis. Of course you'll prevent iatrogenesis. The point is you shouldn't have contamination in the first place because you don't need the GM crops. They have failed to give better food, better traits. They have, in fact, created a worsening of the environmental crisis and definitely a deepening of the peasant crisis and the small farmer crisis, and there's no evidence bigger than the farmer suicides in India. Literally, there are no farm suicides where corporations aren't selling seeds, where farmers are using their own seeds, and definitely no farm suicides among organic producers, especially organic producers using biodiversity. Which brings me to the final set of issues I'd like to share with you. I mentioned the bilateral agreement that is replacing the World Trade Organization's rules of agriculture. And those rules of agriculture were drafted by Cargill. The Cargill officials were deputed to be your representatives in government. They wrote the agreement. They represented the United States in Geneva. They got a treaty in place. They came back, implemented it, and are now implementing it around the world. I often say it should not be called the Agriculture Agreement. It should be called the Cargill Agreement on Agriculture. Because if we wrote the Agriculture Agreement, it would look a bit like this amazing, wonderful manifesto on the future of food that was produced by Wendell Berry, Carlo Petrini of Slow Food, you know, just everyone who's worked, the Greenpeace, the Soil Association, all the movements that are trying to create alternatives. And it was a region of Tuscany in Italy which sponsored, which even now, I mean, this commission exists and the president and I chair it. That's where the principles of agriculture are. And the principles are about land, they're about farmers, they're about food as a human right, they're about food sovereignty, they're about putting people, not corporations, on land, they're about decentralized agriculture, all the principles that are the basis of your activism on campus. The agreement on agriculture has three clauses: export competition, domestic support, and market access. Does that sound like food and agriculture to you? Yeah. In the WTO, they have this interesting thing of, you know, when they do super secret negotiations, they call them non-meetings or non-papers. You know? Because they leave no trace behind. So I think what we need to start saying is non-agreements, because that was totally secret, non-agreements or non-food to destroy the food of the world. So we need other agreements, and those agreements will come through solidarity. Those agreements will come through the kind of, at the local level, the kind of partnerships that are being built. At the international level, changing fair trade to recognize that fair trade cannot be fair if it's not fair to the earth, if it's not fair to local producers in the producing country, and even more importantly, it's not fair to local farmers where the import comes, which leads you to have fair trade only in things you cannot grow domestically. Fair trade cannot be fair if it is importing what can be produced locally. That map that was shown in the presentation by Nancy, you know, where things are coming in and going out in the same quantity, we call it the Great Food Swap. Of course, the Great Food Swap is a great trade growth, because for the trading interests, it is not zero. You know, for the citizens, it is a zero-sum game because you're exporting as much as you imported. But for the trading interests, it's a doubling because they're importing and they're exporting and they're making money twice. And they're collecting subsidies along the way. Yeah, they're collecting market access subsidies from every government. And you will always wonder why imported things end up being cheaper. Because they're subsidized. Locally produced things aren't. And therefore, the issue of fresh and local will have to take up the subsidy question that distorts prices. The subsidy question that makes it cheaper for chemical toxic food to be cheap and organic to be costly, an issue that low-income people say, but organic is not for us. Organic is for all. I now run a campaign with street children because I don't want it. I mean, the entire idea in India is organic is for exports, so we say, no, organic is for Indians too. Why should we eat toxics and send good stuff to the Europeans and the Americans? And by the way, in this knowledge agreement on agriculture, President Bush has said he will import mangoes from India, but they have to be irradiated. Irradiated mangoes. I think we need a huge campaign, since you can't grow the beautiful Dasheri and Kamli and Alfonso out here. I think we need a campaign on organic mangoes to get out of this nuclear irradiation as an assumption of safety. Yeah? Just like nuclear is being rendered safe in energy, it's being rendered safe in food. The alternative we are proposing, you know, I told you about this journey of 10th May. We call it the Bij Yatra, the journey of the seed, the journey of hope. We will hold classes, literally. We will hold a mobile seed university. We're renting a truck. We're going to be showing films, but we'll also be having sessions so that the farmers who've only grown BT cotton the last 4 years are able to imagine another farming. And we'll have the seeds right there for them to say, and you can adopt it in the season. That's why we are traveling at 50 degrees centigrade, and you can convert it into Fahrenheit. But 50 degrees is half of the boiling pot of water, and it's hot. But we are doing it now because this is when farmers sow. This is when farmers are preparing their fields for the next season. Makes no point to let them be victims of Monsanto for one more season. Along with that, for the knowledge agreement on agriculture that, as I mentioned, is an agreement driven by Walmart and Monsanto, where campuses in America and campuses in India are going to be involved in research exclusively focusing on genetic engineering. I regret very much I did not actually carry the list of campuses, but I can send it, or I can have it mailed and pass it on so that through your networks, you can see which of the University of California campuses will be doing what and build the alternatives here. I would love to. In India, we have started the People's Knowledge Agreement, People's Agreement on, you know, the Knowledge Agreement in Agriculture, Bush, Monsanto, Manmohan Singh, Walmart. We are talking about the People's Knowledge Agreement in Agriculture, which is about people's knowledge, which is about organic farming. It's about ecological systems. But having listened to the presentations, I think we need one that joins us here and all of India. I think it'd be wonderful. And I can just see if some of you come to India and travel, and I'll take you to the agricultural campuses where the others sponsored by Monsanto will also be traveling through. And those 90% faculty who are not happy with the corporate agenda will just get that much more confidence. The students who are not comfortable with that agenda will say, yeah, there's another way. And I would really like to build on this, and I hope we can, as part of a partnership that actually started last year when two students, Tim and Peter, came to India, spent a month, and the idea of that exchange was this. We are living through very strange times. Globalization is, in fact, resurrecting the failed paradigms. Yeah? What had failed in America is now being brought to life by transporting it to India and China. That's exactly what's happening. So nuclear failed, so bring it to India. Yeah? Exploitation of labor has failed, introduce it through China. Whatever fails, find another country where you can do your dirty work and then make it look like India is shining. China is booming. But of course, they're getting a bit scared of China's boom. We started this exchange because we felt it was very important for students in this country to know the reality of what globalization is from the eyes and lives and experiences of the people of India. Not the corporations who make money by relocating in India, not by governments that are actually transplanted from Washington. Three of our top leaders literally were planted out of Washington from the World Bank and IMF. So they carry the Washington brain. You know, you've heard of the Washington consensus? Well, unfortunately, it's become part of Delhi. The Washington consensus is so virulent, and it is now in Delhi, and we are being governed by that consensus. I think it's extremely important to take the best of what we can do and what we are doing and multiply through synergy. Of course, it's important we do it wherever we are, but if we do it in isolation and these gangsters are connected, then they are hell-bent on destroying the future. They don't care. They are hell-bent because they anyway can't see beyond a quarterly return on the stock market. That's their limit. That's their foresight. And we need to think hundreds of years ahead. And we need to think in terms of what our lives today leave for those hundreds of years ahead. I think if we do nothing, I really do seriously feel our species is at risk of future survival. All conditions are leading to the annihilation of our species. We've put many other species to extinction, but the extinction of our species is possible in the foreseeable future, within our own lifetimes. If not by ecological catastrophe, by total civic decay. By creating unlivable societies. But we don't have to go that way. All the good work that's being done, good work you all are doing, the good work the farmers of India are doing, the good work the movements working on ecology and social justice are doing worldwide, are definitely creating another world. And I think that other world is based on two fundamental principles that are required in dealing with unaccountable and limitless power. Yeah. Unaccountable power means you can't influence it directly. It's beyond the reach of democracy. It has made itself immune to democracy even while it mouths a lot of democracy. And the second thing about unaccountable power that has become immune to democracy is it has no feedback system. It is so locked into its own self-perpetuation that it does not even have a sense of where its own projects could be faltering. I want to just give you a little footnote on that. Nepal has been a lot in the news because of the total collapse. Yeah? 60% of it is being now run by the Maoists. The remaining that was under the king is being sought. You know, the people are saying we want to govern ourselves. You don't hear the story because your newspapers will only tell you how good India is as a destination for investment. That the more they push foreign investment, the more they appropriate land, mountains, forests, for water, for mining, for power plants, for steel plants, the more they sow the seeds of people having to defend themselves. 30% of India is under the Maoists. 30% of India, the big mineral belt and the forest belt and the tribal belt, beyond the reach of government. And if this is pushed harder and harder and harder, this game can't continue in any case. But I would prefer to build the alternative not through violence but through non-violence. I think it's wonderful that at least some people are defending the interests of those who are forgotten and whose voices have been taken away. But it would be best if the voices of people are reclaimed for everyone, not through the barrel of a gun, but through the reopening of a democratic space, which I have called Earth democracy in terms of including the rights of all species in our concern for freedom and therefore our obligations to protect all life on Earth as part of our freedom. But it's also Earth's democracy in terms of re-embedding our freedoms in us being beings of the Earth, citizens of the Earth. Everything done in the economic paradigm today is making us believe that we are not Earthlings. Yeah. We sit in a stock market. We are figures and blips in an electronic fiction. But our lives are surely defined by our biology. Our biology is defined by what we eat and what we drink. And partly because of the violence I saw in agriculture, but partly because of the potential of what we can do through food and farming, I decided 20 years ago the rest of my life would be excitement through producing good food, making sure the connections that are being prevented from being made get made, and creating new concepts of freedom by practicing another freedom. And that other freedom is based on self-organization. Self-organization means you don't wait for permission from the powerful to do the right thing. You start to do it. But of course, the powerful who have appropriated illegitimate power have spent all their time thinking of how to make your life illegal. Yeah, they've spent all their time saying, oh, let's make it illegal for farmers to save seeds. Let's have patents on seed. Let's make it illegal for small producers to sell in local markets. Let's create sanitary and phytosanitary measures. And it's now part of Homeland Security, as you know. Food safety is part of Homeland Security. But all that food safety does is shut down the local chicken farm, shut down the local cheesemaker, shut down the small kitchen, shut down the small restaurant. They're trying to introduce it in India under an integrated food law that would shut down 80% of India. Under that law, 80% of India and our delicious street foods and all our wonderful dhabas would be illegal. The only safe things would be Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Pepsi's horrible chips. Since the laws are designed to make ordinary freedoms illegal, because they're designed to encroach on the spaces through which people reproduce their lives, we have to remember Gandhi and Martin Luther King. We have to remember that freedom is the practice of freedom, and if illegitimate, unjust, immoral laws interfere in our fundamental human duties and in our fundamental human freedoms, then we have an obligation to not obey. That is... Yeah, and I started Navdanya with this idea that it is crazy to treat seed saving as a crime, and we will build a movement through which we will save seeds. But when the laws start to be implemented to make it illegal, we will have to tell the government, sorry, our duty to the earth and the laws of the earth and the ecological laws and the duty to our human community and the laws of humanity, which are universal laws, are higher than the corporate laws that you are writing on pieces of paper. We will not obey. So I handed over to our Prime Minister 5 million signatures last year on a new seed law that would make it illegal for farmers to save seeds, and we will continue to do it. We will continue to do it with joy. We'll continue to do it with resilience. We'll continue to do it with love, deep compassion, and an outrage channelized into the most peaceful expression of creative power and creative force that lies in all of us. Thank you.